Hello and welcome to the Professional Insight Podcast Season 6. You never really know what the episode is. It doesn't really matter, really.
The last invoice didn't have the episodes on it either, so I can't even tell you. We've hidden the episode number, so I don't know. It's like 30, I think.
My name's Brandon Curry.
I'm Jeff Collins.
Josh Bond.
Oh. And Trevor Lindy. Musical chairs on the screen.
Yeah, it was musical chairs there for a second. For anyone that's downloaded the audio, that's why there was a bit of a delay because of the musical chairs, the tiles. Just wanted to recognize our guest today, the CEO of Merit Asset Management, Roberto Cadillac. How are you, sir? Thank you very much for coming on the show. You are a very busy individual. We started this process about a couple months ago with a fellow colleague of both of ours, Chris Bone, and we're so glad to have you and the company that you're obviously, just full disclosure for anyone that's listening or watching, our firm uses Merit, and so therefore that was one of the insights that Roberto and his team have. We are one of the tools that we use to decide on, you know, where to put people's money, you know, where do we find the economy going? A lot of amazing insight, but I'd just like to do a formal introduction. So Roberto assumed the role of CEO of Merit Asset Management in June of 2023. Congratulations on first quarter in the books. Before your appointment, you were the firm's institutional strategist and head of sales and marketing from 2017 to 2023. But before joining Merit, you took on various roles in renowned financial organizations such as Manulife, Equisoft, and CI Investments, to name a few. You have a finance degree from the John Molson School of Business at Concordia University, and you are also a financial analyst charter holder. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. Thank you all. And thank you for getting my last name pretty well there.
Ooh, I had a boy.
Did I nail it? Did I nail it? Like, I mean, like,
you
practiced
nailed it.
Like,
did you practice that all day or what?
Well, I did, of course.
So John Molson, did you have to like drink beer as you were doing your studies?
That is part of the prerequisites. Yeah, that's the last course, actually. Before you get the hat and you go on stage, there is an exam on that. On being able to pub crawl, I guess. It was a long time ago, so maybe things have changed.
Could you still pub crawl today then, Robert?
Oh, God, no. I have two kids, and the only thing I crawl is when I hurt myself walking on Lego. Off the ground, I'm crawling. That's how I crawl these days. So.
Nice.
Lego can mess you up.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
So there. Before we get into the economics and the city and I mean the country and where you see the global landscape, can you take our listeners and our viewers through your career path? A lot of people tune in wanting to know, I mean, and then maybe at the end, because you are a CFA, I'm a CFP, as a CFA, can you just tell people the difference and where would they see typically a CFA and a CFP? And obviously, you and I work, and your firm, we work well together. But coming from a CFA, let's go about that road. So
acronym being Certified Financial Advisor versus Certified Financial Planner,
Chartered Financial Analyst.
Okay.
Versus Certified Financial Planner.
Perfect.
Ooh, CFA sounds really good.
Yeah,
you gotta get that, Curry. You gotta get that. Yeah. Curry, you gotta go get that.
Yeah. Add those letters. Listen, my career path is a little bit, I guess, different from the maybe typical executive path. I actually started in the industry back in 1998. I was a student at John Molson, going to school full time at night, and working for an advisor as an associate during the day. So back in those days, we had to actually fax in trade tickets. There was not a lot of automation there, so that kind of dates me. But I did that all through university. After university, I actually, and that's when I actually started the first level of the CFA. After I finished university, I come from a long line, I guess, of entrepreneurs. So I think, you know, I decided to throw my hat in the ring in terms of starting businesses. So I actually took a little break from finance for a couple of years, about 2 or 3 years. I launched a couple of businesses in Montreal. Some worked very well, some did not work very well. But in that kind of 2 to 3 year period, you kind of realize that you kind of miss the, you know, the finance side. So I then got back into the finance side, finished up my CFA charter, then worked for a company that does financial software and analytics. That would be the Equisoft that you mentioned earlier. Did that for a couple of years through, I guess, the financial crisis, a couple of years. And then realized I wanted to really get back into asset management. And that's when I actually took a role with CI initially as a business development associate, working myself into vice president of sales for about 6 or 7 years before I was asked actually to join Merit as the institutional strategist. And obviously, as you mentioned, I guess 6, 7 years later, I just took over as CEO one quarter in the books, as you just said. So that's my career path. So.
Easy time to jump in there, right?
Yeah, you know what's it's interesting is when I started my career, I was actually in the late 90s. So I started in 98, and we went right into I learned early the tech crisis, the tech bubble. So I've seen a number of cycles, a number of trauma for investors, and I think that's kind of why my personality kind of gravitated towards fixed income and kind of the alternative space, just because you know, having seen, you know, and dealing with clients as you do, Brandon, the emotions and the roller coaster it is to be investing in very volatile markets, as similar to what we're seeing today. I just felt, you know, there's got to be a different way to do things. And I think that's also why I gravitate towards alternative fixed income rather than just kind of traditional fixed income. So,
yeah. So what would the difference be there? Sorry,
Great question. Alternative versus traditional fixed income?
Yeah.
Well, basically, and I should answer your question early between CFA and CFP, so just remind me to do that after. But sure. in traditional investing, there are certain rules that traditional money managers kind of have to follow. They don't have certain tools that alternative managers have in their toolbox to enhance returns or to lower volatility. So there's rules around leveraging. You know, most of the cases you hear on alternative investments is oftentimes horror stories about alternative managers leveraging up, taking too much risk at the wrong time, and effectively almost you know, becoming a headline and a disaster within the industry. So there's some leverage that can be used. We're very, very, very conservative in terms of users of leverage. So that's not really focus on. But in terms of the other tools that we have as alternative managers, there's risks in my space, which is fixed income. The two biggest risks in fixed income are actually what we call interest rate risk. So the volatility of rates that we've seen that's typically driven by central banks creates volatility in bond prices. Basically, the simple thing to remember is yields or rates go up, bond prices usually go down. That's something that we want to have tools at our disposal, be able to hedge that volatility. It's almost like, you know, being able to buy insurance, similar to how you buy life insurance for your own your family. We can actually buy almost portfolio insurance for our portfolios. Those tools cannot be used by traditional mutual funds. And also, as I said earlier, going through multiple cycles of and crises and financial crises or tech bubbles, we actually have tools that traditional managers don't have to protect us from recession risks. So we're big users of these kind of tools. And the whole goal behind that is really have the insurance and protection in place at key moments of a cycle to protect protect the downside. At the end of the day, we're just trying to lose less money than everybody else at the right times. And obviously the guests here being involved in real estate understand these cycles also in real estate. If you can protect yourself from corrections in real estate prices, similar to we protect ourselves in financial markets. If you're in a position and you have the dry powder because you've lost less money than everybody else, you can actually take advantage of those deals and take some pretty good exposure to get some pretty good returns at the right time. So it's really the tools that we have in our toolbox that traditional managers don't have. And the other thing that we also enjoy about being alternative fixed income managers is Traditional funds are all categorized within the industry. So that means they, to serve a certain category, they have to have constraints. Because we're in a category that really has no constraints, we can actually exercise full flexibility across our mandate. So that's kind of the bullet points, I guess, in traditional versus alternative managers.
No, excellent. Makes sense.
If you, while we got you, if you wanted to talk about the difference between a CFA, a chartered financial analyst, and a CFP, certified financial planner, by all means, please.
Yeah. So certified financial planner is really that high level designation that your advisors have to actually qualify for. And that really encompasses the global aspects of managing an individual's client's portfolio, which would include, I guess, the holistic approach. And that's not just money, but I guess it would be also involving taxation, insurance, et cetera. A chartered financial analyst is more, it's quite a rigorous degree. There's a certification. There's three levels. The pass rate is very, very low. Not to toot my own horn, but I think the pass rate is only like 15% across the three levels.
Wow.
And that certification actually allows you to kind of focus more into the deep, into the weeds in terms of all aspects of financial management. So it's not just asset management. There's aspects of accounting. There's corporate finance. There's obviously understanding portfolio management, understanding basically how to analyze stocks, bonds, building global portfolios, understanding alternative investments. So it's quite a rigorous degree and really dives into more the nitty gritty in terms of actually building the underlying components within portfolios, but also all aspects of finance in general, because finance is a very, very broad word, I guess. So
now I'm not the financial guy by any stretch of the imagination. So does that kind of tie into like a discretionary status or something along those lines?
No, because discretionary, like a discretionary portfolio management title, is actually something separate. So that's by default, anyone who actually has done the CFA charter, typically you automatically qualify as a certification to be a discretionary portfolio manager.
Okay.
But every portfolio manager does not get to qualify for a chartered financial, because the chartered financial is like portfolio management designation is kind of here, and the CFA charter is kind of like
gotcha. This, yeah. The bigger
I'm on the radio, I'm doing this big motion with my hands.
Yeah.
This is small circle on portfolio management versus big circle on CFA. Yeah. So I got to be conscious of that. So just remind for the listeners,
the larger umbrella,
the larger
CFA. Yeah, obviously larger
shape.
Yeah. And the other thing that I don't like, you're right. It is across all three levels. The CFA, the CFP pass rate's 55% or something ridiculous. Goes lower if you have to take it again. The CFA has three different levels: level 1, 2, and 3. I don't know what that pass rate is, but it is also because most people don't get through it. And then on top of that, you go and write your third and final exam, and you're marked on a bloody bell curve, which is even the worst. So it's not even whether or not you know the knowledge. Which is just, I fundamentally am against bell curves. I just don't agree with them. If you know the knowledge, you should get it, right?
So for the CFA level 1 exam, just to kind of give you an idea of what that encompasses, I kind of tell people it's like writing your entire bachelor's degree. So basically it's 2 3-hour tests where you're responsible for the entire knowledge base of your entire bachelor's degree, and they could test you on anything at any given point. So that's kind of how you, in terms of the breadth of knowledge that's required, and you also have to be pretty quick to recall information. So that's kind of gives you an idea of the how rigorous that first level can be.
Roberto, whereabouts are you located? Are you in Ontario?
So Merritt is actually based in Toronto, but I'm actually born and raised in Montreal. And so I actually fly into Toronto every week. So I just got back last night at midnight. So I was there. I'm probably there 2-3 days a week. And then the other days I'm kind of flying all over. It's Vancouver.
The most important question to me, Roberto, are you a renter or do you own a home?
I own a home. And in fact, I just shopped mortgage rates Before this call, I was just talking to my mortgage specialist, trying to figure out what I'm going to do next month. So
there's a guy right down below you that can tell you what to do here.
Yeah.
What did you find out here? Because this is the million-dollar question going on right now.
To be honest, I'm leaning variable.
Yeah.
I'm leaning variable, I think, and we'll probably talk more about this, but, if you can get anywhere close to where the 3-year fixed is on your variable, I think that's a good call. And that's kind of, I don't really like the 1 year. I think it's just, I just don't like the differential between the ones and twos. I think, if I locked in at 3, I'm pretty sure if the differential is only a quarter point, I think for 36 payments, I'm going to win out if I take the variable. Yeah.
So you're predicting 3 years from now,
the rates will be quite a bit down from now? I think the central banks 3 years from now, I think we're probably 250 basis points lower.
Yeah. What do you think 1 year from now? I'd love to hear what the CFAs, the CFPs, and the everybody, honestly, all the financial.
I think 1 year from now, easily the Bank of Canada could be 100 basis points lower.
So the biggest question, when are they dropping?
Well, let's put some context.
Brandon, you want to get into this? You got right into it.
This is what affects my income. So I need.
First of all, what is the 3-year right now? 3-year fix. What's the 3-year fix? 5.5.
I got a 3-year fix at 6.15.
6.15.
Trevor can do it for 6.45.
Yeah, I got a 2-year quote at 6.91 and 1 year at 7.20 or something.
Yeah.
So just for our listeners and our viewers, today is October 13th, 2023. We are 12 days away from the Bank of Canada announcement happening on Wednesday, October the 25th. Just so when we're, because people download these episodes and they watch them at different times. So just because I don't want Roberto to say something or give advice on something, right? Because things,
put it in context.
Economic data that we actually have. But back to Jeff's questions. I mean, so the differential you're getting back on a 1-2-3 year fix between a 2 and a 3 is about 25 basis points, is what you said?
Between the 2 and the 3, it's actually closer to 65 basis points.
65 basis points.
Yeah.
And what are you getting your variable at right now? What are they quoting your variable at right now?
I'm trying to get them down to.
Of course.
They offered me 6.5.
Okay.
I got another one coming in at 6.36. So I'm trying to see which
one. Ask Trevor the tricks to get it down. He must have
Trevor,
some insight.
Give me the tricks.
Yeah, what's the tricks here, Trevor? How do you get it down?
Honestly, the bloody guy never talks half the time. This is
Rachel. This is his moment. We're setting it up for you.
The CEO of Merit right now asking you. Let's go. Come on, Trev.
It's like professional insight in silent Trev, right?
Yeah. The problem is, though, banks won't compete against monoline lenders. Mm. Monoline lenders are going to be your cheapest pricing, right? Most monoline lenders right now, variable loan to value less than 65%, purchase, transfer, no refi, prime minus 90. So you'd be looking
at what's a monoline?
Okay, so that's a prime 720.
Yeah.
Okay, so 630.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But I even, like, my mortgage is with Scotia. So when I was up for renewal a few years ago, I went to Scotia and I said, listen, this is what I can get from, you know, MCAP, First National, Merricks, listed out the monoline lenders. They're like, nope, won't compete. Won't compete against them. We'll compete against brick and mortar. TD, BMO, RBC, they'll consider them. They won't even compete against HSBC. It's unfortunate.
See, this is the hard-hitting stuff we bring you at Professional Insight, Roberto. Inside information.
And monoline being what, Trev, that they don't have bricks and mortar?
One line of business. All they do is specialize in mortgages.
Mortgages, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So 6.3.
The lowest it's going to get right now. Unless you've got somebody that'll buy it down.
And you got an offer of 6.3, do you not?
I have 6.36. So it's not far off.
No.
So do you tell them buy it down or go somewhere else? That's what you tell them. You got to negotiate, Roberto. Walk away.
Yeah.
So let's get back to the question at hand. Well, that was great. And that's even great for a Habs fan. I mean, to get that in depth into his knowledge on his.
Sorry about the other night. Sorry about the other night, Jeff.
We're so sorry.
Right now, they're one game out of first place, though. He's feeling good still. No. One game out of first.
We got a chance. There's always a chance.
So back to the original question, which was, okay, let's break this down. Some big things have happened in the past week. The first thing is we do have a Bank of Canada announcement happening on Wednesday, October the 25th, 2023. What are your feelings? Where's the 50-50 split? If you're a betting man, what do you think is going to happen with the Bank of Canada overnight lending rate?
Yeah, I think it's a hold. I think it's a pause. I think
based on why? Yeah, what are your analysts saying at Merit?
Well, when you look at just what's going on and what would prompt central banks to increase rates, the big theme that we've seen since they actually started rehiking and then pausing is the Canadian economy is starting to show signs of weakness. I mean, we went through one quarter of negative GDP. We had the unemployment rate in Canada go up, from 5 to 5.5%. And by the way, that's not because participation rate increased in Canada. It's just basically there was not enough jobs created given how immigration is going in Canada. And also given population growth in Canada, we basically bring in about 80,000 people a month. You actually need 50,000 jobs created every single month for that unemployment rate to stay stable. So the Bank of Canada has basically said, you know what, we're close to destination. We've seen a lot of the, I guess, excess demand that they were looking for come off. That was a threat earlier in the year because they had to rehike. That's coming kind of cooling down here. We have the labor market, pockets of the labor market starting to soften, which is also positive for what they're trying to do. They don't want an overheating labor market. And also, at the end of the day, you have to understand our economy is much more sensitive to interest rates than other economies like the U.S. Canada is an open economy, meaning we rely, well, basically the Canadian economy is fueled by, 15 to 16% of our economy relies on the real estate industry. And the other, a large part of it is trade. We export a lot of commodities. And obviously, as you know, there's no massive infrastructure or global growth going on. There's not a lot of demand for commodities. So we're much more sensitive. And obviously the dynamic of the Canadian consumer. Like if you look at the Canadian consumer debt relative to income, it's worse than the Americans were during the financial crisis before they had their issues. And by the way, rates are higher. Like you have to go back to 2002 to see where the last time we were this high in rates. And obviously, as we all know, and as your guests or your hosts know here, we don't have 30-year mortgages in Canada. We run 5-year fix. So there's this wall of maturities of 5-year fixed mortgages that are, it's like an iceberg hitting the economy here. It's just slow moving and it's just coming closer and closer. So at the end of the day, they know they're already at restrictive levels. They don't need to take rates higher from here. But what they do need to do, though, is maybe keep them longer at these levels, a bit higher, a bit longer than markets are typically used to. So just again, to see more weakness in the consumer to make sure that that inflation complex is still moving in the right trend. And obviously, there's been some volatility in oil prices. Food pricing, oil. Yeah, I mean, there's still some volatility there, which is why central banks don't necessarily want to signal that they're officially paused. What they're going to say is like, we will monitor data and give themselves optionality because if they actually signal that this is the last pause, then markets will probably rally. That's going to work against them. So anyways, that's all that's being said. And we think that the tightness of levels that we've seen here are sufficient enough, just allowing time to slow the consumer. And you're already starting to see that work its way through the economy, especially in Canada. So the Canadian central bank, similar to how, they started raising rates ahead of the U.S., they could more realistically be ahead in terms of actually cutting rates at some point or, pausing and then cutting rates into maybe middle of next year.
Well, that's what you figure Q2 next year, your best guess, or?
Yeah, I mean, look, if we bank another negative quarter of GDP for Q4, that's two negative quarters of GDP. I mean,
technical recession,
that's,
right?
That's a technical recession at a time where, you know, like the more
weird, it's just odd because certain things are really moving. Crazy. Right?
You know, the only like think about what they've done. We built our economy, found an equilibrium the last decade and a half on zero rates. All of a sudden, central banks raise rates 500 basis points, and you're not going to break something.
Yeah, and don't give it time.
You know,
I look at it differently. I look at it from build a realtor standpoint, because the fall in the market and all that. But during, I'd say about a year ago, and everybody probably could speak to the same thing. You could not find a tradesperson to do any work whatsoever. Yeah. You had to beg, beg, and they were so overrun with business that they picked and choose when they wanted to do it. Right now, every day I open up my email for my building company, it's a new tradesperson looking to introduce himself, looking for business and asking for business. And I'm in tune with trades, not just from building, but for real estate clients and stuff like that doing work. And they're all slow right now.
Yeah.
Like my flooring guy, who's as good as it gets, has finally said, "You got anything, let me know." Let me know. And so that to me,
and
you know,
he is
more
good
at a lower level. He's excellent. But at a lower level down here, that trickles through the economy about what's happening. Because think about pools, right? Like I'm waiting for the pool thing to switch because I want to put a pool in next year.
Yeah.
And pools are at the peak right now. And they're probably still getting installed because of purchases a year ago.
Yeah, exactly.
But all the other trades, they are looking for work right now because they've hired many people. Yeah. But now they don't have enough work to keep it. So to me, sliding out of the summer, going towards Christmas time, which will be a good indicator, how much money spent at Christmas this year, right? Like it's going to be interesting.
You know, sorry, Jeff, on the pool thing, I bet you not next summer, the following summer is when you're gonna get your best price if you're waiting.
Yeah. Well, right? I have to shit or get off the pot right now. I think I'm going to pull the trigger and do the pool myself and my guys because I can buy the kit at a reduced cost. Because I think most people now, like, I assume all families the same thing. We used to go to a restaurant once a week, whatever like that. Now we're like, you know what? Let's just buy and cook at home right now to save some money, right? So it's now like I'm buying, it sounds bad because you should support local, but I bought a new weight set for my son and I'm looking for free weights. Have you seen how much free weights cost?
It's insane. Yeah. Was it $2 a pound now?
Like $3 a pound.
Is it really? So I found it used to be $1 a pound before the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. But I found 300 pounds of weight in Olympic bar, all for $350, brand new. But I got to drive to Mississauga and back to pick it up.
Yeah.
So to save the $300, I'm like, whatever, I'll go for a 2-hour drive, pick it up, right? But that's the way, you know, some families are looking for ways to save a buck and all that, right? And that's what's happening.
You don't get a pool soon, Jill's going to slap you.
I know.
So back to the economy. Actually, just to further, Rookie actually just texted me saying he has some friends and himself that, you know, help out in the pool industry, and it's down 33%. So there you go, Collins. It's starting to trickle their way through.
Shoot me a name, Rookie.
So in Q2, in the Canadian economy, we had negative GDP growth. I believe it was a minus 0.2% contraction.
Yeah.
How are we trending for Q3?
I mean, look, the early data that we've seen is consumer spending is reaching their limits. You know, just as like we overspent on goods back in the pandemic, we're starting to see a lot of, let's say, stronger weakness on the services side, so it seems like the consumer is now overconsumed services. Now, because we're also facing even higher rates than we did back in Q2 because they started rehiking rates, in our view, that's just going to permeate further. So we're looking at probably, you know, flattish growth probably for Q4. But again, as you start to see more and more headlines coming in that, you know, you're starting to see some dislocation from the employment side, maybe coming in flat to even a little bit negative for Q4 would not be surprising to us.
We had Dr. Thorne on, Dr. Jim Thorne, and he's going to be coming on again on our show the day after the Bank of Canada announcement. And it's funny, this is one of the reasons why I really rely on your team. rely on your team and also rely on the insights of professionals and ourselves, because, you know, it can kind of get convoluted. So I'll give an example. The Stats Can report for September job growth in Canada, you know, they're like, oh, analysts expected 20,000 and it ended up being 63,000. And then Jim Thorne goes, you're not reporting on the second page of the Stats Can report, which basically said that was all government jobs.
Yeah, education.
Or self-employed jobs, not the private sector's not hiring.
No.
To that.
And the same thing, by the way, in the U.S. There was a big U.S. print last week of 320,000 jobs. Right now, on the number sounds really big, because typically you're getting job growth, like basically in the U.S. As I said, Canada, you need 50,000 jobs per month for jobs to grow, for the unemployment rate to stay stable. In the U.S., you need like 125,000 jobs. Okay. The U.S. puts out a print the other week of 326,000 jobs, and the market celebrates it. Hey, look, the unemployment rate's so low. We're creating so many jobs. But if you actually look at the job, look at the quality of the jobs. It was all part-time work.
Yeah.
And so when you look at that and you look at some other metrics, because, like, you know, when you're trying to get an idea of the health of the labor market, it's not necessarily just the unemployment rate, because the unemployment rate is the last thing to move. So if you're waiting, you know, the unemployment rate is moving up when you're already well into the recession. It's the laggiest. It's the latest of all the indicators. So you actually have to look at earlier things like initial unemployment claims. You also have to start looking at some of the things that we look at in terms of trying to get an idea of the health of the actual labor market is the quality of the work that's being done. So basically, as I said earlier, you had a job creation in the U.S. of 320,000 jobs, but most of it was part-time. So basically what's actually end up happening right now is a lot of full-time workers are losing their jobs and they're being replaced with part-time jobs. However, though, when you actually add up the hours worked, let's say you fire one person and you replace them with two part-time people, instead of actually replacing them with two part-time people working 40 hours a week, they're only working 35 hours a week. So when you look at a number like a 300,000 job creation, it sounds like, wow, the job market is really tight, it's expanding. But you actually look at the hours worked in the entire economy, it's actually going lower. So that's important, because we actually understand the effect on the economy. It's not about the number of jobs. It's about the amount of hours worked in the economy times wages. That's what gives you what we call gross domestic income. That's the amount of income generated by the entire economy that can be spent in the economy.
Yeah.
You could have 300,000 jobs being created, but if it's all part-time work and they're only in total working less than full-time hours, the income generated by the economy is actually going lower. So
now how do we reconcile that with grappling with like a societal shift to more of a part-time, you know, at least one of the working incomes is more part-time, or sometimes two of them now. Right.
Since you have to work two part-time jobs, because guess what? Your mortgage rates is going to be double what it was in Canada, right? Like I was speaking with someone the other day, obviously young buyers, the new house, they bought at the top and they took out variable mortgages, barely qualified. They had to get parents help them out with the qualification.
Yep.
And now they're about to renew, and they're not only number one, they take variable, their payments are going up 30-40%. They were never even able to afford that before if they didn't get a helping hand. But now they actually have to pay the mortgages themselves. Yeah. And probably what you've seen, Brandon, is maybe you had some of your clients have maybe come to you and say, hey, Brandon, I need $200,000 because I have to help out my kid with their first house.
Yeah.
You know, but now that generation actually is now facing higher rates. And guess what? Now they got to work two jobs. You know, they could afford it on a full-time job, that mortgage, but now with rates the way they are, they're working two jobs, right?
And that's
firing anybody. So imagine if, you know, you're getting this kind of pressure on the consumer before the labor market has actually turned in Canada. So imagine if you actually get people having income destruction because they're actually losing their jobs because we're going through a global slowdown and you're facing these high mortgages.
Mariana's Trench.
Yeah.
Disaster.
So for everyone that's tuning in just right now, watching us live or has downloaded halfway through, this is the CEO of Merit Asset Management, Robert Kadigbak. Thank you very much again for coming on. But like you're hitting, so it's a bit coincidental. About, I would say 6 weeks ago, Trevor, I think I went to a lunch and learn. It was hosted by CI, which is the affiliate that you were not there, Roberto, but a couple of your team members were doing a presentation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a massive blow off. And I want you to kind of take this because you're kind of touching on the job market and you're touching on a bunch of different things, which is amazing. Because GDI, we've been, gross domestic income has been negative for a while. And that is the definition of unemployed, employed, and not looking, and how you can opt in and out of each category. Yeah, I'd like you to touch on that.
Yeah.
And then the second piece is, which just irritated all four of us, specifically Trevor, when they announced the jobs of 63,000 new jobs.
Yeah.
But that, those 63,000 new jobs, well, one person can have three part-time jobs,
yeah,
and they're counting them as mutually exclusive. Yeah. Yeah. Which, so go, please go with that. It was your team that told me this. We're blown away.
Yeah. Yeah. When you look at non-farm payrolls, as I said earlier, like,
yes,
this is a business survey. So basically they say, okay, did you add a job? But they don't go into, was it full-time? Was it part-time, et cetera. So there's literally double counting going in there, but this is part of a bigger picture where central banks have they're in such a difficult position because the entire labor market data is very, very cloudy. Even, the job openings that you hear, basically there's a statistic called the job openings labor turnover. It's basically you take a ratio of, how many job postings there are relative to, people seeking employment. And there's something like, call it, 9 million job openings. And that's still, a number of millions away from where it was before COVID. However, though, when you have that kind of number of job openings, typically you would say, wow, okay, there's so many companies looking to fill positions. But that number is actually misleading because what we've noticed coming out of COVID is there's companies that are posting jobs that they never intend to fill. So basically you have they have these, what they call ghost postings. So there's been a number of companies that are, they're constantly posting jobs because they're just building a database in case they lose workers. In terms of the tech companies or the small kind of growing companies, typically what they also have been doing is they've been using job opening bulletin boards to kind of use it as marketing to show that they're kind of growing in growth mode, but they never intend to fill these jobs. So that number is very, very cloudy. And then on top of that, when you look at, as I said earlier, the actual statistics, the business survey statistics for labor, it's very, very cloudy in terms of the quality of the quality of the jobs that are being produced is actually probably deteriorating. And that's also signaled, by the way, we have a model that tracks temporary jobs. And typically when you look at the temporary jobs, they're always last in to be hired, but they're also the first out to be fired in the slowdown in recession. And when you look at that chart, basically temporary jobs, this cohort of the working population, they're losing jobs at a rate that would typically signal recession. So when you add up all of these things in terms of, average hours worked per week, the number of hours worked in the aggregate economy kind of flatlining, you look at overtime hours actually going back to pre-COVID levels. You look at the number of temporary workers that are losing their jobs at a fast rate that signal typically recession. That does not speak to a market of a really, really strong labor dynamic. And that's the trouble that central banks have is they have a whole bunch of data that's showing, well, okay, the economy is actually susceptible here. But then you'll get this weird wonky data, which sometimes the numbers are so large that they're almost impossible to believe. But it's just that the data coming post-COVID in terms of the adjustments are just all over the place. And I think that's also why, bigger picture, we think that, when you have central banks that are almost trying to calibrate or land this plane through all of this turbulence, when their measurements, their kind of altimeter or whatever it is, are kind of going haywire, it's really hard to land that plane really softly.
So the question here would be, why is the government providing these numbers, the 63,000 job increases? Obviously, it's optics because they want to maintain the rate or you know, they don't want to decrease it. So they're trying to provide these numbers to show that they can't decrease yet. Is that what they're doing? Because clearly it's a fabricated number, more or less.
I don't think they're trying to work the numbers. I think just the data that they're getting is just, it's just so messy that it's hard to get really clean data. You know, because there was a number that they put out, not last month, because last month was 60,000 jobs. The month before that was only 20,000. So, you know, there's this constant, you're battling a very cloudy measure, and then you're subject to more revisions, which makes it really hard to kind of have a consistent policy that's reliable when it's just the job numbers are moving all over the place because of adjustments.
But how could that be, Roberto? Like, why are we dealing with this? Like, why isn't this corrected, right? Like, I mean, it just doesn't make sense for us to go off fictitious numbers, right? Like,
honestly,
it seems like clickbait optics.
I don't. It's just this is the mess that we're kind of in. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of numbers that are reliable, right? If you look at consumer spending, if you look at if you parse out inflation and certain pockets of inflation, there are numbers that are reliable that will kind of give you an idea of the trajectory of the overall economy from a growth perspective, from an inflation perspective. It's just the employment backdrop.
But you would think at this macro level, right? Like, I mean, they would have this figured out by now, right? I mean, obviously, you know what I mean? Somebody like yourself understands it. I mean, you're sharing this information with us to help us understand it. But I mean, you think somebody at the governmental level would be like, like, you know what I mean? We've got this wrong.
Well, Roberto, if you were in charge, but
to be fair, Josh, like,
yeah.
And this maybe come back to an earlier point, is that I think central banks are okay if the data supports that they should hold rates where they are. Because the danger that central banks are facing right now is not where they've taken rates, it's if they cut rates too early.
Yeah, makes sense.
Okay, so if they cut rates too early, it's one thing to get in. By the way, we're not at target yet with inflation with central banks. The road is looking good though. We're trending towards target here, and if you look at the last 3 month rolling, we're kind of getting there, right? But you just need more durability in the data.
It takes time, right? From once it they takes, drop.
Yeah, there's a lot of base effects that have to roll off. But the danger though is, it's one thing to get inflation to your target, because this is the crux of all of this thing. If you cut rates too early, what happens if inflation reaccelerates?
Sure.
Yeah. Right. So it's better to err on the side of caution and actually almost overhurt the economy. Look through strong job data if it supports, you know, your narrative of, you know, we got to be vigilant against inflation. Because the alternative is a disaster. Okay. In the 70s, there was a wage price spiral that was created because there was policy mismanagement and, you know, inflation expectations got what we call de-anchored. The consumers back in the 70s completely got their view versus consumption inflation completely broke down. And we face a similar thing in COVID. You know, our relationship with inflation completely broke down when we came out of COVID. Normally, okay, if you look in a normal inflationary environment, when prices go up as a consumer, if you're not over-earning on wages, you got to spend less.
Yep.
Right? To reflect that, you got to cut costs. You have to kind of buckle down. You have to make choices. But, you know, that's a normal inflationary environment, a normal relationship with inflation. When we came out of COVID, that relationship completely broke down. Because when we came out of COVID, we were deprived so much of consumption. When they finally opened the economy, we wanted to consume three times as much, no matter the cost.
And a lot of people had savings, right?
They gave us money to do it.
Yeah,
they gave us we had maximum excess savings. Oh, you know what? You're a student. Don't bother paying your student loans. Spend that in the economy.
Yeah.
Right. So not only did you have the psychology, the appetite, you had the dry powder to actually overconsume. that's a breaking of inflation expectations with the consumer. And this is something that central banks are, this is enemy number one, because the last time they saw this was the 70s, and that cost the economies 10 years of growth.
Brutal.
Yeah.
This is why. Brutal decade, right?
They will, you know, if the numbers support a tighter policy that helps them stop us from moving into this higher inflationary regime, I don't think they'll really matter.
See, it feels like in real estate right now, there's just a glut of buyers that are just on the sidelines sitting there, and they're waiting for an interest rate downturn. Like the second it goes, it feels like they'll jump.
So this I'll tie into real estate a little bit here, into what I just said earlier. Okay,
now
so
there's
this, there's this idea, like, okay, so let's talk about the end game. What are central banks really trying to do? Okay, yes, they're talking about inflation. Yes, they're talking about employment. But at the end of the day, the real end game to all this is, as I said earlier, they're really worried we're about to move into this higher inflationary regime, like in the 70s, and they're convicted that they need to break this. And the way to do this, and this is the recipe, and what they need to do is, number one, they need to soften labor markets. And what that means is you got to get the job openings down, and you got to get the unemployment rate up. Okay, because once you get the job openings down, the unemployment rate up, you don't have so much of this wage pressure that they're really worried about. Okay. Number two, you need to remove the ability for corporations to defend their margins, and you need to lower confidence. So in Canada, consumer and corporate confidence is linked to the real estate market. In the US, it's linked to the stock market. Okay. So this formula that they're trying to produce is in order to solve a problem that they've realized that came out of COVID. Coming out of COVID, as I said earlier, you had consumer psychology around inflation completely broke down. Okay. So we didn't matter. We were consuming. Not only that, consumers were actually or workers, what they realized was wages were, I'll try to describe this, wages were low, inflation was high. So basically your wage gains weren't keeping up with inflation. And central banks are really, really worried we're entering this phase where there's going to be massive wage demand catch up. So, and that's what you're seeing today. All of these strikes you hear about, you know, auto worker strikes, you know,
Minimum wage just raised again, minimum wage, too, right?
This is because there's this massive wage demand catch up because everyone's going to the grocery and saying, how can I live on this bill, right?
Yeah.
So you got that happening. And then you have companies. What central banks have noticed is that companies are revising their prices more frequently post-COVID versus pre-COVID. Because in a normal inflationary regime, companies don't increase their prices so frequently because, you know, they're fighting for market share. They're sensitive to price demand. But coming out of COVID, guess what? It didn't matter what things cost. We had the money in the appetite. We bought it anyways. So corporations are more than happy to pass on 100 to 125% of the inflation on the consumer. Okay, so now why is that important? Is if you take these two things, if you get a whole bunch of the population basically demanding wages, and if you have companies all over-earning and very, very profitable, every time there's a wage demand, if the companies are very profitable, they can give in to that. That's called a wage price spiral. And that's what they're trying to break. So if that's the case, in Canada, if the unemployment rate goes higher and you have companies that are basically having their ability to defend their margins removed, and that's creating an environment of lower confidence, the real estate market is going to go down.
So we should go out and fire somebody.
Yeah. So that was a dramatic pause for you guys.
Yeah, no, for sure.
but it's just normal, right? And it's just, you know, we're again, as I said earlier, you do not build the amount of credit that we've taken out in our economy in Canada. That kind of leverage was based on rates equilibrium of zero. And now you're raising it 500 basis points. Like, I looked at the mortgage renewals that are coming due, right? So the 2018 mortgages, the five-year fix, they're going to be 200 basis points. Like, they're coming due this year. They're 200 basis points higher than when they originally took them out. Next year, they're 300 basis points higher. The 2020 mortgages, five-year fix, are going to be 400 basis points higher in renewal. Now, you can't tell me that's not going to affect your consumption. 100%. This is not 5 years away, guys. This is 2 years away.
Yeah.
Every year that goes by, a large portion worse. Of the market is getting squeezed, right?
Worse, progressively worse, right? Because
so you've seen real estate
three, four in about 2018.
Yeah, real estate prices have come down because rates have gone up. The next wave typically in a cycle is when real estate prices go down because of forced selling, because people are losing their jobs. That hasn't happened yet.
No.
So your buyers that are waiting on the sideline, they're waiting until they have no more job.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden they're going to be renting again, or they're staying with their parents.
So Trevor, one thing to note though, with the interest rate piece, yes, they were paying significantly lower and now they're going to be 200, 300, 400 basis points higher. But we've always had, well, since 2016, we've had that stress test where we've been qualifying people 5%+ since 2016 on an insured basis, 2018 on insured and conventional, right? So in theoretically, it's been baked in, but they've had the
extra. They never stress tested these levels of rates though. That's not in their models. They never thought rates were going to get this. Like if you're stressed because
you're stress testing at 9% now, essentially, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But who's paying an interest rate of 9%? Nobody.
No, right? That's why you're not getting the mortgage bill. That's the problem.
Stress test.
Yeah.
But they're paying that interest rate.
You still can't, you're not getting approved for the mortgage. So,
no, they can't at 9.7 if they're qualifying for a HELOC, right? 7.7, they're qualifying at 9.7. They can't qualify for that, right? Whereas previously when we were, I will agree that we weren't qualifying people at the current rates, but we were qualifying people as high as 5.5% previously, sure. Right? Because they thought that rates wouldn't go higher.
But Trev, that's 4% difference, right?
Yeah.
So no, because they're only paying a rate at the highest rate that I've done recently, besides in the A private world, is like 7.25%.
But even at 7.25%, you got to qualify them at 9.25%.
I agree, but the point I'm making is that person, when I qualified them at 5.25% or 5.5% previously, okay, now their new qualifier is 7.25%.
But understand also the problem is that banks are facing risk of loan losses. So you might get clients that come in and they could look all good on paper.
Yes.
But their loan books are just shrinking because they don't want to take that risk, right?
And agreed. And OSFI has mandated
in the real estate market, right?
And then, right. OSFI's mandated that
exactly build capital requirements now. We don't like how much amortizations are pushed out beyond 25 years. That's just more pressure. This is how the transmission mechanism of central banks work within the credit channels, right? This is exactly how they slow things down.
Yep.
So it's whether you look at because that what we're talking about right now, that's called maybe you've heard of this. This is the Senior Loan Officer Survey. Okay, so basically the Fed, central banks, they take they do it in the ECB as well. They take in the U.S. the Fed takes polls of 80 banks, okay, in the U.S. and they say, okay, what's your openness to lending? What's your lending standards like? And then they ask, okay, well, what's demand for credit been like? Because it's two things, right? It's your willingness to lend, but also who's demanding the credit. That's what leads to credit growth, right? That combination is at levels that we haven't seen since usually crises like 2002, 2008, 2020. That combination of tight lending standards and the demand for credit is very, very tight. So,
but housing demand's at an all-time high though too, right?
There is still demand for housing, but it's starting to shrink.
There's demand for housing, but if you notice all the transactional houses, you guys know, it's all new builds, right? In the U.S.? Like in the U.S.?
New builds are dead right now.
The market is not moving. You've seen numbers that are the worst they've seen in 27 years.
Yeah.
Of course that makes sense. You have mortgages at close to 8% in the U.S., right? So who's going to break their 2% mortgage unless you're structurally unemployed and you have to move or you're moving because of a job?
You know what moves around here, Roberto? It's bungalows, because the empty nesters with no mortgages, they're downsizing. They don't want the stairs. They have no mortgage, so the mortgage interest rates don't affect them. They buy, then they go sell.
Structural movement, like every, that's just natural.
Yeah.
But I'd say that the big buyers, the waves that really, create growth in the sector, this is,
But a lot of the builders aren't building either because the margins aren't.
No, they're holding off. They're holding off.
Yeah. And apparently a lot of them were offering teaser rates, right? To get people to buy.
Or like, you can buy down rates on them and all that too, right?
With incentives. Like, so, you know, tack up the price of the house, but I'll finance you and give you a better rate. But either way, there's a certain limit you can do that, right?
Sure. Like,
there's just, at some point you start to see the economy slowing and you say, you know what, I don't want that exposure either. You know, because you don't want to get like, it's either someone might get hung with that loan. It's either the bank or it's the builder. So it's like, you know.
Yep.
So I guess, I mean, like the another thing that really shocked me was in the last week or so, and I'm sure. So first and foremost, I mean, you knowing this information and you're telling us this information, if one thing goes, you know, a little bit off or whatever, obviously you've instructed your portfolio managers and your team to hedge, obviously, because you have that ability to hedge. But I mean, a big thing that was really shocking to me was a couple of states, a couple of governors of some feds of certain states,
speakers,
New York State being one, Missouri being another, I believe, came out and publicly said, I think we're going to be holding the first week of November, which, so tell our listeners and our viewers about that. And that was kind of shocking for us to hear. I thought it was like, wow, you're speaking out.
Yeah, like in the U.S., there's a number of voting members at each meeting, right? I think there's like, I believe it's 19 voting members. And what's interesting in the last three or four days, like four or even five of them, and some of them were actually some of the most, we call them hawkish, or some of the, when we mean hawkish, I mean, some of the governors that were the most, aggressive in terms of rate hikes, even they started kind of softening their language around what was necessary. Because what ended up happening over the last week or so is you started to see movements in the bond market that actually starting to weigh on all asset classes and would eventually weigh on the real economy. So it's called like the curve or the longer end bond yield started to move higher. And typically when you see that's something that, you know, we call them, it's called term premium, but it means that you started pricing in, or risk asset or market started to price in, that the Fed was going to be higher for longer. And if the Fed is going to be higher for longer, in terms of long end rates, this is very difficult for the real economy to actually be able to withstand kind of like these, such a robust or optimistic outlook. Because as you start keeping rates higher on the long end, well, from a consumer perspective, obviously, credit is more expensive for longer, that slows consumption. For corporations, don't forget, they need to, in order to fuel capital expenditure, they have to issue bonds. Well, you know what, if they're going to be having rates higher for longer, then their cost of capital is going to be higher for longer, which eats into profitability. And also, by the way, the byproduct of having higher for longer in terms of yields also tightens global growth, because typically what ends up happening is that the US dollar actually strengthens in value. And that basically is a headwind to the commodity cycle, to global exports, et cetera. And then just for stock prices, higher for longer is not a good thing, because that actually makes stock prices usually should be adjusting lower if rates are higher on the long end. So you're getting, you know, that all of that tightness that could be flowing both from the financial and real economy comes more concrete the more you have central banks. And this is typical when central banks, like, they'll never say we are paused. They never say that. But what you start to notice is that more and more the tone of the central banks as a collective group starts to change from being very rigid in terms of we need more hikes to saying, you know what, the balances of risks are not just on inflation. Now they're balances towards growth and financial stability as well as inflation. And then they start talking about how, you know what, some of the, like, as you just noted, some of the conditions are tightening. The bond market's doing that for us. That's a form of tightening without actually us having to raise rates. And that's typically what you start to see around when they're about to pause or they've paused. And we actually think they have paused. We think they've paused rates. We think, you know, actually the first cut in the US is priced in for, let's say, late summer of next year. So late summer of next year would take you into kind of like August, September, July, August, September, about that time. And if that's the case, if they're going to be cutting rates in July, August, September, the bond market and what we invest in actually rallies well in advance of the actual cut. So typically what you start to see is when central banks start signaling that they're pausing, there's this period, this phase that happens up until what we call the first cut or calibration. That's where bond markets typically rally a lot, even in anticipation ahead of the actual cut itself. And by the way, equities do okay as well. It's just, you know, whether we're going into a soft or hard landing, you typically have a really big rally in bonds. So that's why we want to be exposed to that. You bonds are cheap. Any way you slice it from a nominal perspective, from a real rate perspective, if you look at asset classes, bonds versus equity, we'd argue that bonds haven't been this cheap since before the financial crisis. So.
Well, and just to put into layman's term for, well, just to put into layman's terms for everyone that's listening, basically, Roberto, and correct me if I'm wrong or I misspeak, but basically as interest rates increase, bond prices decrease, there's an inverse exactly. relation. So yeah. what you're basically saying is on this, you know, on the 20 and the 30 year terms, which is we've seen some massive yield growth in those. We have an inverted yield curve that's happening right now. Basically, why am I going to hold on to a 30 year bond giving me 2% when I can sell at a discount and get a 30 year bond or treasury bill or what have you at 5-6%? And that's what's happening right now is people institutional investors are wanting more interest on their bonds of the amount, essentially, is what you're saying.
I think it's also more so that people have left what we call the longer part of the curve. So 10, 20, 30 year bonds, people have left that because they're worried about a couple things. Number one, that there's going to be a lot of bond supply coming going forward because basically, governments are running deficits now, large deficits, and they need to finance that, right? So you issue bonds to pay the bills, basically, right? Also, they're worried about foreign buyers not showing up as much as they used to. Basically, you had a lot of, you know, Japanese insurance, life cos that would buy a lot of longer term bonds. But if yields in Japan are going higher, then they're not necessarily going to buy as much in the U.S. So there's that. And also, by the way, central banks, right? Central banks were some of the biggest buyers of bonds in the last decades. They're no longer buying bonds, right? So there's that fear that actually made those 20 and 30 year bonds to really cheapen up, which means their yields kind of went up. Yield curves were actually inverted, but they call it re-steepened. But now at these levels, now it's actually really, really interesting because when we talk about bond valuations, as I said earlier, we haven't seen bond valuations this cheap than since before the financial crisis. You're basically getting paid, a guaranteed return above inflation of 2.5% to grow your wealth. That's probably the best asset class in terms of valuation that we've seen across relative to equity or relative to other asset classes. So, there's a number of things that make the bond market move. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to understand that we probably are going to be going through the best years of fixed income now that central banks have raised rates 500 basis points. Because as you said, when yields go up, bond prices go down. But when yields go down, bond prices go up, right? Mm-hmm. So now if we're at the peak where they've raised rates, probably they might have overly raised rates, to be honest. They probably raised rates too much and the economy is already going to slow down whether we like it or not. In that instance, they're going to be cutting rates. And if they cut rates, because long term, the Bank of Canada doesn't want rates at 5. Okay. They want it closer to 2.5. They just want to be sure before they move rates that inflation's been defeated and not going to reaccelerate. But if you know that over the next few years, they're going to be cutting rates from 5 down to 2.5, and you make money when they cut rates, that's why bonds are really attractive because you know they're going to be cutting rates over the next couple of years. It's just a matter of how fast they cut rates. But whether it's slow or fast, if it's fast, then you make a lot of capital gains. And that's what, you know, your listeners should start to understand is bonds aren't just about the coupon. You could actually make capital gains in bonds. You can make returns like stock returns in bonds, really boring government bonds.
Yep.
You know, people are shocked when they hear that, but it's true. When central banks are cutting rates because they reached the peak policy, that's when you actually get equity-like returns out of boring government bonds. And you know what? If it's slow, you're getting really good yields right now, you know, 4.5 to 5% to sit and wait for the Fed to cut rates.
Now, I'm very conscious of your time and the amount of time that you've given us today. I'm very conscious of your schedule. So do you still have a couple more minutes to chat a little bit further?
Yeah, sure.
That'd be great. The CEO of Merit Asset Management, Roberto Kadakbak, is on our show today, giving us some great advice, some great insight. This is amazing.
Now we just like saying your last name.
It gets sharper.
I'm nailing it every time. This is amazing. So you mentioned the U.S. Your team, basically a lot can change between now and late summer, but based on the data that you're seeing, based on what have you, you basically have priced in a rate cut in the U.S. about late summer of 2024.
Yeah, we think they're gonna.
So what is your team and your thinking about a rate cut and also total rate cut in 2024 for Canada? So when?
I think Canada can move a full quarter earlier. As I said earlier, the dynamics in terms of growth, the dynamics in terms of our interest rate sensitivity is so much faster than in the U.S. And as I said earlier, similar to how Canada was the first before the U.S. to hike, they're probably going to be the first ahead of the U.S. to even cut, just given the dynamics that we spoke about. So we think that, you know, Canada should be cutting a quarter, maybe even two. That would take you to kind of like late Q1 or mid, you know, or middle of next year for Canada, and then kind of like the U.S. in the back half. And, you know, typically what you see is they could probably start, you know, once they start cutting rates, it would be normal for them to start cutting, you know, maybe 25, 50 basis points in consecutive meetings. They'd probably take a pause. And that's actually the fine line where you're going to start to see whether what we call a soft landing is possible, or more of a harder landing / recession is actually what's well underway. Because if they start cutting rates, by the way, the sooner they cut rates, the sooner you can escape what we call a hard landing. So not a recession. So, but we think they're going to be a little bit too patient. But once they start cutting rates, 25 and then 50 basis points, if the economic data continues to decelerate, then pretty much the hard landing / recession for Canada is already well underway, and there's probably nothing they can do to stop it. And then if that's the case, then they're going to start cutting more aggressively. So you can see another 50 basis points, 75 basis points cut, you know, as the unemployment starts to go higher, because it's that, you know, it's just that loop starts to happen where finally you've broken consumer confidence, you've broken corporate confidence. Companies are no longer hoarding labor. They start firing. Firing leads to breakdown of demand services. It leads to lower inflation. It leads to finally a rebalancing of the labor market. But even though they start cutting, they can't fix that trajectory fast enough. So I think anywhere from 50 to 100 basis points of cuts for Canada for next year, the sooner they started, the sooner it'll be closer to 50. The later they start the cuts, the more it's going to be closer to 100 basis points for the year.
Be more aggressive on it the later they go.
Yeah.
And are you calling
they've over tightened, so they have to try to fix faster.
Yeah.
You know, the damage that they've already, again, I just want to remind listeners here, like we built an economy for a decade and a half on zero rates. Okay. We typically are not built to withstand 500, like that's abnormal, guys. Like central banks have raised rates 5% in the past. Okay. It's happened before, but they did it over 5 years. It gave people time to adjust to a new dynamic. They did this in 18 months. It was historic what they've done. And now you're asking the consumers who are already, Canadian consumers who are already overly indebted, to just all of a sudden shoulder that. It's a tough ask, right? So
it's ridiculous.
That's why it's like even if they cut rates sooner, they might have just already overdone it.
Right? What are the odds we're going to end up in the US 2007, 2008 situation?
Great question, actually.
Yeah, I don't think. It's a tough one, because I just think Canadians are, even though our debt levels are high, very, very high, we're fiscally more responsible than the US. They when they took that real estate kind of over leverage, they took it really, really far.
For sure.
You know, we typically, okay, you know, yeah, some people have several properties, but I don't think they had five or six in the, you know, that some of the US guys were doing, or a lot of the US cohort was doing. I think our banking sector is much more stable than obviously than the US banking sector.
Short amortizations for sure, right?
Yeah, it's just so, you know, I think I also have to recognize that the labor market is still, you know, as much as we say it has to weaken, it's still in a pretty decent spot, right? So I don't know if we'll go to an 08 crisis. I think the biggest variable is commercial real estate. I think that's just we obviously in Canada there are certain banks more exposed to commercial real estate than others. They're already buffering for loan loss provisions, but you know, we've gone through issues in the 90s, early 90s with commercial real estate. It's not new. It rears its ugly head every now and then. So I don't think it's going to be like an 08. I don't think we're calling for like a financial crisis that was fueled by over leverage and probably undercapitalized balance sheets from the financial sector, which we have the over leverage part of the consumer, but I think the capitalization is okay.
I think the interesting part is going to be it's the shortage of housing, and it's, the real estate market's not busy, but every incentive's about to come from the government to start pushing housing again, and the builders don't want to build because the profits aren't there because they're not selling. Yeah. So what's going to happen is I think the first shoe dropped when they said they got rid of HST on the rental buildings.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see that coming soon, or at least the development charges taken off or something to incentivize the builders to come back, because they're just not building unless it's a custom build right now, right? There's the spec houses that were up before are no longer there.
No, they want their margins. Yeah, they want their margins, right?
Oh, damn right. Any business would want their margins, and they're not going to bother being in it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, with the rates the way they are in certain things, I mean, you could take that money and park it, right? And make a better margin with your money parked, right?
So the big thing on building, if the building's not happening, that's a lot of trades and a lot of jobs that are all of a sudden not working, right? Yeah. And that doesn't count against the job market because they're still self-employed, but those builds are little mini economies.
The money goes down, right? That's the whole point.
Well, but you see the bow tipping now, right? Like it's...
Well, like I get it. I get bombarded with emails of people looking for joint ventures and vendor takebacks and everything for land development. And before, you couldn't find land anywhere. And now every incentive is there to buy if you want to, but rates are high, so it's hard.
Yeah.
It's going to be an interesting, because Ontario's got to do some kind of incentive for the builders right now. They have no choice or they'll stop building. And that's the only mandate that seems like they have right now is more housing, more housing, more housing. So we'll see.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Roberto, for coming on the show.
Go Leafs.
Yes.
Go Leafs. We loved having you. This was absolutely amazing and an eye
opener. Fantastic.
Fantastic. It's great to hear that, you know, when we have such educated people on our podcast, and it seems though, you know, your Preet Banerjee is your doctor, you know, your Dr. James Thorne's, you know, yourself, like all thinking the same and all basically going, you know, there's some change, you know, we're reading the tea leaves now, regardless of what the media is saying. This is what the experts are saying. This is what our teams are saying. And we really appreciate your time because it's a very busy schedule. So thank you.
Thank you all. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, thanks.
The takeaway is look at the bonds, right? The takeaway is look at your bonds.
Yeah, if you have to understand. Yeah, I know some people are parked in high interest savings and GICs. It feels good to have that kind of a rate, but when central banks have reached their peak rates, bond portfolios always outperform cash and GICs. Always, every cycle, and that's where we are, right? Yeah. So start thinking about now if this Bank of Canada is going to start cutting rates next year, you got to start maybe, okay, we were in cash. It's time to kind of redeploy. We weathered the storm. Now let's go make some money.
Right on.
Totally making money.
All right.
Thank you, Roberto. Really appreciate it.
Amazing.
And Kim, we'd love to have you on again.
Go after the cup win.
I'm gonna wear, my hat jersey next time I'm on the
no! Okay, no more.
No you more for Trevor. It was nice
knowing I'm you.
Thinking I'm gonna have to wear my Habs jersey next episode.
Isn't that your Habs jersey on right now? It looks like a Habs jersey.
If we're waiting for the Leafs to win, we're still not doing this podcast in 25 years. I'm sorry, but
wow, that would be the greatest podcast ever after a Stanley Cup victory, because it would be just you eating. You would have to eat a real crow
and wear a toilet seat over your head.
If the Habs win the cup before the Leafs, then you're gonna have to do something, Jeff.
Oh, that ain't happening. Not with that first round pick.
Wow. thanks.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Sorry about your team affiliation, Roberto.
All right. We've got
give the wrap up to Lindy for his hockey team. Let him beg for forgiveness.
So, Lindy, you got 2 minutes. Give our listeners something market based, whatever. What are you seeing? I mean, I thought it was very interesting that Roberto is going variable.
The clients that are the clients that are in a variable right now are,
I love the music.
Like, hey, I've weathered the storm. So, oh God, they've weathered the storm 500 basis points already. So why not just tough it out a little while longer?
Yeah,
right. So,
you're advising variable right now. You're advising variable.
It's hard to advise variable unless they're a variable rate customer, right? Yeah. If they're a variable rate customer, it's a lot easier to, say, hey, you've already waited this long. Do you really want to lock in at such higher rates? And Roberto made a very valid point when you're looking at the difference between that 3-year versus the 5-year variable. And those rates are so close, makes a ton of sense. Now rewind, a couple of months, I can say I got a 3-year for a client at 5.2. Well, that's significantly lower than what a variable rate would have been offered at that point. So, the reality is the market right now has priced in further increases, right? Because of the data that's been coming out, and we'll kind of hopefully start to see it soften soon. I don't know.
Is that Ron?
That's
Jeremy,
all I got to say. Good
That's
God.
Trevor Lindy baseline right there. That's Trevor Lindy baseline.
Okay, Bondo, go. What do you have for any of our listeners or our viewers?
We had an instance last week where we had somebody buying a house and they didn't have photo ID. You got to have photo ID. You have to have some measure of photo ID, passport. And we ended up by squeaking it through at the 24th hour with lawyer hours and banking hours to push this through. Just get a piece of photo ID, right?
So what did you do to correct that, to fix it at the end?
There was an undertaking that was signed that the individual would have one supplied within a 20-day period.
So like Ontario photo ID, because if they can't get a license kind of thing?
Yeah, even a passport. You can get an emergency passport, right? But, I mean, it's... with all due respect, just get it. If you're looking at buying a property, make sure you have one piece of photo identification, please.
Okay, that's interesting.
Collins, you got less than 2 minutes. Go.
I love it. I've done lots in 2 minutes. What I would suggest right now...
Sometimes twice.
Both kids, both boys. I'd suggest right now, because I'm talking to quite a few people and they're looking at lots to potentially build. I think it's a great time for lots. If you kind of predict out, I was watching some shows last night on building and custom building and all that. You're looking at really 6 months to a year before you're probably ready to dig. And then 6 months to a year to dig. So potentially you're looking anywhere between 1 and 2 years. If you found a piece of land that you like to buy, I think right now land is not moving so quick. But you have to look at, when you're looking at land, people don't pay a lot of property tax on it. So if it's been in the family for a long time, there's no carrying costs. So they'll sit on their price. But I do believe you could get much longer closes. So if you are looking to build, I think it's a great time. You're at the bottom of the market. You can plan properly. I believe you could probably buy land right now, negotiate some off, but the bigger thing would be negotiating a longer close. So I'm talking 6 to 8 month closes you could probably get right now with a firm deal. And the firm deal allows you to start planning properly. Now, if you want to plan, there's three places you need to call in Niagara. So if people want to do their own due diligence to see if they can build, because not many times, as we know, the realtor will list what the potential for build is or not. It's always do your own due diligence. There's three places you need to call. First and foremost would be the city to verify the zoning to see if building's possible. Secondly would be the NPCA to see if there's any restrictions on that. And third, to make sure, would be the region. The region could have something in place where there's archaeological or forest protection, and not necessarily would the NPCA have that, because the NPCA, which is the Niagara Parks Conservation Authority, will advise you to talk to the region too. So my advice right now, if you are looking to build, and if people want to build, they want to build, they want to, and I think it's the best thing. I've just built, and I'm not saying that because I'm a builder, because you get exactly what you want. I think you typically can build between 15 and 25% lower than market value. So in a way, you're making that kind of money. But if you plan it right now, you could secure land, have a long close, design your house, close, start your build, take your time to build, and then you can sell the house that you currently live in just before you're ready for possession and potentially get a gain on that house. Again, in the house you're building, and save quite a bit of money on carrying costs if it's designed right. So if you have any questions, give me a call. But that'd be my advice right now.
So a double dip.
Potential double dip, potential triple dip, because no carrying costs on the land either. Because a lot of people like to close real quick when they have land. They want the money right away. Go for a long close. You know, so I'll give you your money. I want an 8 month close. I guarantee you probably get it on some indications right now.
That's right. Well, we just had an entire, we just had an entire episode of what I do for a living. So there's really no point in.
Talk about the Leafs, bro. You got 2 minutes. Talk about that game. The hat
the
trick.
Game was awful. The game.
Hat trick.
I fell asleep and it was 5-3. I was like, that's it. They're done. My daughter woke me up when they're in overtime.
But that shows you the difference, Curry. Every other Leafs rendition they brought would have lost that. So what did you want from game one? You wanted to show a little bit of piss and snot, which Bertuzzi dropped it and everyone jumped on that. You want to be able to come back to a game that didn't mean anything at all.
Got in there. I love that.
Didn't mean anything. And then you wanted Matthews to start off hot. He's got a hat trick. Perfect game one.
And just a little stat.
Against a bottom feeder.
Fastest player in NHL history.
Who?
Score 300 goals. Auston Matthews, 482 games. And keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that we had a 56-game 2020 season because of COVID. So he actually was dealing with, 26 less games than previous people that have hit that mark. Because if you got to look, you had Gretzky, you had Lemieux, you had all these people. So to do it in with definitely a season with 26 games left, that was a lot.
Shit kicked out of them.
Oh yeah, 8-1. But not to take a shot at our boy Matthews, there's a Twitter comment that looks like his hairline is coming back. So I got to look for that next time I see him.
I don't really care.
Comment on that. I love it. All
right,
let's get that. Ron
okay, Bondo,
look.
Help us help you stay informed.
Ciao. Oh,
thanks, everybody.
Hi, I'm Emily Roger, and I host a leadership show called The Boiling Point with my co-host, Dave Vail. Together, we sit down with trailblazing entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and movement makers who are driving meaningful change in our world. The show is all about exploring the lives and perspectives of leaders who are making a difference. Join us for insightful conversations that challenge the status quo, spark new ideas, and inspire you to take action. Find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or at BoilingPointPodcast.com.
The Podcast Super Friends is a monthly meeting of five podcast producers. Hi, I'm Catherine O'Brien from Branch Out Programs in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I'm John Gay from Jagged Detroit Podcasts.
I'm Matt Kundle from the Sound Off Podcast Network.
I'm David Yes from Pod 617, the Boston Podcast Network.
And I'm Johnny Peterson from Straight Up Podcasts.
Together, they form the Podcast Super Friends, an alliance of podcast masterminds sharing best practices, insights, and discussions to help make you a better podcaster. Follow or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at soundoff.network.
Hey, yay! Hey, yay!
Produced by Cryer Media and distributed by the Sound Off Media Company.